changing of the seats over here reminded me, several years ago, one of my students went to Green Gulch, and she was staying there for a few days, so she was in the dormitory, and she started talking to another woman there, and that woman had been coming and staying at Green Gulch for a little, like, private retreat for many years, but they got to talking in the afternoon, and my student said something about how she was, you know, going to be getting up and going to the Zendo the next morning, and the woman looked at her and said, "You go and sit in the Zendo?" She said, "Well, yeah, I mean, that's what I'm here for." She said, "I've come here all these years. I have never dared to go to the Zendo." And my friend was a little surprised by this, but she said, "Well, why don't you come with me?" And she said, "Okay, I'll just sit at the back so that, you know, I can leave if I need to." And, you know, I just laughed so hard when I heard this because the person had obviously been to other meditation groups, particularly Vipassana, that they sort of sit in rings around the central area. And so if you really do want to just try it out or leave, or you sit at the back because no one will notice. But in Zen practice, there is no back. You know, there's this. And if you leave, everybody knows you're leaving. And if you come, everyone knows you're coming. And I thought, well, there's an interesting difference. So there's no hiding in Zen, which makes perfect sense to me, that we're all out here being vulnerable and open with each other and doing this this opening, awakening practice together. So I imagine that many of you did something to celebrate Thanksgiving on Thursday. And so I just wanted to start with this one quote on gratitude. This is a book written by Soshitsu Sen, the 15th. They all take the name of Sen, the headmasters of the Urasenki and all the other schools. And I don't think this man is alive anymore, so Mr. 16th is now in place. But this is what he wrote. This is actually what his father wrote. "A man spends his entire life sitting in meditation at the peak of a great mountain. His deepest gratitude is for being able to sit in such a manner. Without such thankfulness, whatever we do will amount to nothing." I've been thinking a lot about this because you know, I started practice over 30 years ago, and I will never, ever be able to repay this debt of gratitude I feel for not only having found it because a couple of people wrote about it and I got to read what they wrote, but that when the student was finally ready to show up, the Zen teachers were already all in place. San Francisco Zen Center was there, Green Gulch was there, Tassajara was there, my teachers were there. And so really my vow for the rest of my life is to be there for others as they were there for me, and to just be incredibly grateful to be able to do this practice in the sun and in the rain and in the snow and whatever is happening. It was so great this morning, sitting with the sound of the rain coming and going and the wind, and then the wood stove would make its little crackling sounds, and I thought, what could be nicer than to be sitting here right now? So, I think many of you, but not all of you, know that I am actually related to this practice more closely than many people who are in my lineage. I'm in the San Francisco Zen Center lineage, but I actually claim a dual lineage. And that is because my tea ceremony teacher, Peg Anderson, was a student of Kogen Chino Roshi's. And when I first started practicing with her, a month after I had started practicing with my teacher, Les Kay, she said, "Oh, you have to go to Jikoji. The best Zen master in the world is there." But being a good Zen student, it was like, well, I've just said I'm going to be this other person's student. It's kind of difficult at this point, a month later, to say, "Oh, excuse me, but I found someone better." So I didn't do that. But I still feel that I have something from Kogen Chino, because when I think about the things that I actually am teaching and how I am being in my own Sangha with my students and with myself, it's really Peg's teachings that I return to again and again. And I think she really had Kōben Shinō's way. I did not know Kōben Shinō-sensei that well myself. I did know him. But sometimes the student of a teacher, if they have it purely, can pass that person on. As I did not know Suzuki Roshi either, but I've had several teachers who did know him and were very close, and I feel they passed his way on as well. So my tea teacher had a Japanese master who was a painter, and his name was Saburo Hasegawa. And because she didn't speak Japanese, for a long time she would say Saburo. And it only was much later that I found out there was a U in there, Saburo. But even the Japanese often drop the U. You know, when you say wakarimasu, you don't really pronounce the U at the end. So I always thought he was Saburo, S-A-B-R-O, and so did all of his other American friends, to the point that he finally started signing his paintings that way. He did not sign them Saburo, he signed them Saburo. So Saburo was a painting master, and he was at the California Institute for Asian Studies, I think it was called, something like that, in the old days over in Berkeley. And people like Gary Snyder were there, and D.T. Suzuki taught there for a while. So my tea teacher was going to take art appreciation lessons, Japanese art appreciation lessons from him. And she and her friend Gertrude did this for several times. And then one time, Saburo walked in with a bowl and a whisk and some tea and a little tea scoop. And he said, I'm going to make you some tea. So he did a very miniaturized, simple version, which is what I'm going to do in my workshop this afternoon, of tea. And Peg was just mesmerized. She's like, what is that? Everybody knows how to make a cup of tea. Mostly we get a tea bag, or maybe if we're really sophisticated, we get loose tea and we put it in a pot. But this was like something she'd never seen. And when he explained that it was just sort of a simplified version of tea ceremony, Peg was, can you teach us this? Well, in his wisdom, I think he realized that if he was going to teach them, he should really teach them, not just this small thing, but the real thing. And he made them be guests for the first year. They were not allowed to touch the tea things other than to drink from the bowl. So he said, they got a stricter training even than I did. So Peg studied with him for many years, and then when he died fairly early, she studied with his wife. But because he wasn't an official tea master, he didn't have a certificate. She didn't get a certificate. But even after Saburo's wife died, she continued studying with other teachers. Until finally, one day, the current tea master of my school, which is the smallest one, Mushinakoji Senkei, came to visit. And my current tea teacher, Richard Malott, who was a director up at the Asian Art Museum, brought this man down to visit Peg because he knew about her. And she served him tea. And I'm sure she must have been rather nervous because she knew this was the grand master of her tea school. He was delightful. But at the end of the tea ceremony, what he said to her was, oh, you serve grandfather style. Peg was like, oh dear, is there a problem? Is that wrong? No. She said, well, should I learn the new style? Oh, no, please serve grandfather's style. So for years, that's what I was learning, was this really old-fashioned style that anyone who was doing the current style would recognize was old-fashioned. Now, I in my innocence would not have known the difference particularly. But now with my current teacher, who does know the current style, there was a whole lot of having to let go of very small details of this and that and doing something new, which, believe me, is really wonderful Zen practice. Because one of the tea students kept saying, well, that's not the way Peg did it. And I finally had to take the person inside and say, you know what? Peg is dead. this is our teacher now, this is who we have to follow. And that was the end of the complaining. But it is amazing how attached we get to everything. You know, well, this is the way it must be done because this is the way I was taught. Well, maybe not, right? Maybe there's another way. So tea, like everything else, changes over the years. Little ramifications, personal taste. You know, it's like language. We don't speak the King's English, and the King's English is not the same as Shakespeare's English. Things evolve. So actually what our Zen practice and tea is always asking us to do is be here now with what's ever happening now. To be adaptive, to be creative, to be accepting of what's happening now. So a monk once asked his master, "No matter what lies ahead, what is the way?" The master quickly replied, "The way is your daily life." This concept is at the very center of the way of tea, and I would say the way of practice. The principles of the way of tea are directed toward all of one's existence, not just to the part that takes place in the tea room or in the zendo. In practice, the test lies in meeting each occurrence of each day with a clear mind, in a composed state. In a sense, even one's smallest action is the way of tea. It is this that makes it just as significant today as when it began more than 450 years ago. And I'd say that you could insert Zen practice for the way of tea and it would say exactly the same thing. Our work, always, is to be here in our life. Whether we're a monastic or we're a lay person, an adult or a child, to be here in this moment with what's in front of us. So it is said that one of the skills that you either arrive with or you develop pretty quickly in Zen practice is to observe. Not just with your eyes, but with all your senses, and most of all, with your mind. Because, you know, what else is it that we're doing in Zazen? We are observing the movements and actions of the mind so that finally things come to rest. And we observe that too, the mind at rest. Till finally even the observer falls away. But the observer can't fall away. Body and mind can't drop away until observation is complete and clear. So one of the parts that I really love about tea ceremony is observing the seasons. Each day, each night. And they do, the Japanese do this in many ways. They have all these little ceremonies all year long to honor the changing seasons. There's moon viewing ceremonies, there's cherry blossom ceremonies, there's ceremonies around the falling of the autumn leaves. And they're very close to nature. So when I was first a tea student, you know, my tea teacher served tea in her living room. And every Thursday afternoon, we would go there at 4 o'clock. So all day Wednesday, I realize this now, I don't think it really went in then. All day Wednesday, she would spend cleaning and laying down the mats like this and moving her furniture around. I mean, the living room, it's still, if you were really trying to see it, it looked like a living room. There was still a sofa in it and a chair. But if you wanted it to be a tea room, she had it arranged in such a way that that is what it looked like. But one of the things I really loved when you first walked in on the wall was an enormous scroll in the shape of a fan. I don't know if you've ever seen these, but it's a piece of paper. The two sides are like this, and then there's a curved area here and a parallel curved area here, and that's to represent what a fan would look like before it gets folded and put on the bamboo. And so she had this fan behind class that Saburo had made. So I'm going to pass this little picture around. This is Saburo painting, but that is the fan that she eventually bought from him. There's a big character, and that big character is snow. And then there's a lot of little characters on the lines aside. And it's a story. It's a short story. Snow. It was a snowy day. I wrote a letter to a girl. She replied, "How can I say yes to a man who is so insensitive, so mean, as not to ask me how I was enjoying the snow?" Soon after, she died. I will never forget that girl. How are you enjoying the rain? How can we not appreciate our oneness with everything and express it to each other? This girl is saying, how do you expect me to be intimate with you, to marry you, obviously, when you haven't even asked me about the snow? If it snowed here, we'd all be talking to each other about the snow. It does snow here once in a while. I've been here when it snowed. But it's a rare occasion, and we all get very excited. If it continues to rain like this for 4 months, we'll stop being so excited about the rain, too. The problem for human beings is we like newness. We want everything to be new and exciting moment to moment. And so often people complain that Zazen is boring. This is because when we sit down, guess who's there waiting for us? That old me again. Oh, there's that thought again and again. There's that emotion arising. Well, there's that daydreaming coming up. There's that sleepy Zazen. But when we understand what Dogen meant in the Fukan Zazengi, he says, the Zazen I speak of is not meditation practice. It is the Dharma gate of joyful ease. I love that phrase. When we sit down, we don't have to be anyone. We don't have to do anything. It's such a relief to me. You just sit down and you begin to follow your breath and you observe what's arising. It's neither boring nor not boring. It's just what it is. And then eventually, if you sit long enough, the mind begins to settle, just like mud settles into the water after it's been mushed around. And then there's this clarity left behind. The mud's there. A talk I just gave last Monday was how we're often very grateful for all the good things in our life, but we're not so grateful for the difficult things. And I was thinking, I was reading something that Okamura Sensei had written about the object of Zazen is not to get rid of our delusion. We can't. We're stuck with it. And frankly, that's a big relief to me, because I'm not doing that great a job. It's still there. I'm still suffering from it. So I realized that I'm actually grateful for my delusion. Because why else are we here? If we hadn't finally woken up somewhere along the way to our delusion, we probably wouldn't be practicing. So it is delusion actually that brought me to this place. And it's a relief to know that I probably am never going to get rid of it, so I don't have to try so hard. I can just be with it. You know, it'd be wonderful if I could say I was never going to be angry again. I would really like that a lot. The chances of that happening are like zero. And it's unfortunate, but that's the way it goes for me. This is what I have to struggle with, and I'm sure each of you has your own struggles. And I guess what I'd like to say is don't worry about it. What I would like to say, though, is that for me, tea and practice have been these, I can't even call them parallel paths. They've been the same path. It's just one is the no action side and one is the slightly active side. It's like the in-between between sitting in Zazen and going out into my very crazy world dominated by young children. If you have never taught young children, you need to go to the Monterey Aquarium where I was yesterday on a Saturday, and you'll find out what it's like to be a teacher, because kids are noisy and busy and they want to touch everything and they want to pull on everything and they're bumping around, and this is just the way it is to be a kid. So between this very noisy, busy life over here and Zazen, tea is like this in-between place where I'm in a state of meditation, but I'm also doing something. And the good news is it's something that has a very definite way of doing it, and once you learn that sequence, then you can sink down into it without worrying about, well, what comes next. But one thing I've always really appreciated about tea is its underpinnings. It is one of the Zen arts, right there with Ikebana and Kyudo and calligraphy. And so the principles of tea are really the principles of practice. And there are four: wa, ke, se, and jaku. Wa is harmony. And I cannot emphasize how important harmony is for Sangha. It's important for us individually and in our families. But the wa of a Sangha, whether it is your Zen Sangha, your family Sangha, your work Sangha, it trumps everything. Even when you know somebody is wrong, you try to find the harmonious solution. You try to find the compromise. Rather than taking sides, becoming confrontive, oppositional, you try to find the harmony. So in tea practice, harmony usually happens when you and tea become one. There is no you. There is no tea bowl. There's just the tea. There's a whole relationship between host and guest. And the most wonderful tea ceremonies I've ever been in, host and guest they come together. And I have to say that, you know, I go in and visit many Zen centers and Vipassana groups, and I feel the harmony here. I always feel like this is one of my sort of second homes. I know a lot of that's due to Michael, but Michael has help. A lot of it is due to the rest of you creating this wonderful foundation for everyone else to arrive. That you open your arms, you open your place, and you offer the Dharma. And you offer it freely, which is not to say that you don't have your difficulties with each other. Of course you do. That's what it means to be human. But you don't let it get in the way. That's the point. In tea ceremony, there's all kinds of things that can go wrong. And I'm often serving people who have never been a tea guest. And there are ways to talk to them and show them so that there's no break in the harmony. I was talking to my friend Vicki Austin, though. Her tea teacher was quite much more strict than my teacher, apparently. And one day she said that she did something, and Oka-san turned to her and said, "Vicki-san, after 20 years, you still don't know." She whapped her on the hand. That's fine. Oh, dear. I would never have survived that. My tea teacher, her big thing was she'd just say, "Not yet." And then you'd realize that you'd done something out of order, and then you'd put it back, and you'd look around, and, oh, and you'd realize what you'd done, and then you went and did it. So you didn't make that mistake again. That's all we need to do. Not yet. Wait a minute. Take time. Because part of harmony is patience. There is a reason that patience is one of the paramitas, quite frankly. It is because it is in short supply. And if you disagree with me, all you need to do is go driving out there. There is always somebody who needs to get somewhere faster than you and who wants you to know it too and does stupid things like passing on blind curves or beeping their horn when there is no danger other than I'm late to where I need to be and you're in my way. To develop patience, to be able to be kind, even when people are not being patient or kind with you, this is a practice. But this is what harmony requires. So then we come to the second principle, which is K-E-I. And that's respect. And recently I heard a quote that was attributed to Tolstoy. I know a lot of Tolstoy, and I hadn't heard this, so I haven't had a chance to check on it. But I like the quote anyway. He said, apparently, that respect was invented to take the place where love should be. And I've been thinking a lot about that. You know, we had this idea, all you need is love. Many of us are from the 60s, after all. And we would like that to be enough. We like to talk about it. We like to think that that's going to solve all of our problems. But there are some people you just have a hard time loving. So maybe until you can love them, respect can be the thing that you take the place with. And there are some people in my life that I don't care very much for, but I do respect them. And then there are some people that I love a lot, but I don't respect, so it sort of goes both ways. But I think we need one or the other. We need, I mean, and I don't mean love in the intimate way, but compassion. We need to understand that someone behaves the way they do because of causes and condition. You know, Thich Nhat Hanh, that was one of his big teachings, that we all have the pirate in us and we all have the young raped girl. We all have possibilities that we could or couldn't act on, depending on our own upbringing, on our own values, on causes and conditions that we had no control over before we were born. So in the tea room, respect is not just limited, though, to humans. And the bowls actually have always a beauty spot, the official tea bowls. And that beauty spot is supposedly the most beautiful part of the bowl. And when you're the host or hostess, that part is facing you, so that you are respecting the bowl, and the bowl is also respecting you. But when you go to serve the tea to your guest, you turn the bowl so that now the beauty spot is facing your guest. And there's very polite conversation. The Japanese are nothing if not polite. So, for instance, when the first guest receives their tea, they bow to the second guest and say, "Okaeri nasai," which means, "Excuse me for going first." Now, clearly, that person's first guest, they're going to go first, but still they bow and apologize. And then, when the second guest gets their bowl of tea, they bow back to the first guest. "I'm sorry, I'm drinking." You know, but the first guest is already drunk. So explaining this to anybody who's not Japanese is very funny, actually. But eventually you just get used to, when I bow, you bow. Don't question it. And what you begin to discover is that bowing is really quite wonderful. So I don't know about the rest of you, when you go out in the world, like you're at a store, do you ever accidentally, thank you. And then you realize, oh dear, this is not a Buddhist environment. But you know what? It's become so, it has a certain cachet now. and I think we can thank the Dalai Lama for this, that people will sort of go, oh, and they'll bow back, even though they've probably never done it in their life. It's amazing. It's a new form of respect. So if I were to wipe out all the forms, the Japanese forms, from teaching in a Zen community, there are only two that I would not let go of. I'd let go of chanting even, but I would not let go of bowing, and I would not let go of gassho. There is something about these two forms that empties us of ourself, because respect is honoring the other. So the third principle of tea is sei, S-E-I, and that's purity. This is about having a pure heart. We come to Zazen knowing all our flaws, all our failings, and it doesn't matter, because you come with sincerity, you come with determination. That is your purity. You come as if you have just said the repentance vow. All my ancient twisted karma, beyond beginningless greed, hatred, and delusion, born through body, speech, and mind, I now fully avow. In this moment, I come to it purely. The way that's presented in tea is that, it's very amusing actually, the tea person, the host or hostess, brings out the tea things and they're already perfect. They've been washed within an inch of their life. It's usually, if you're really doing a fancy tea ceremony, everything in the tea ceremony, the whisk, the tea, the sweets, the chakin, the little cloth that you wipe with, is all brand new. Now, those people must have a lot of money, because it costs a lot of money to have brand new things like that. So I often don't, but I always make sure everything is very clean. You create purity within the tea ceremony, but what's interesting is part of the tea ceremony is to clean the bowl again in front of your guest, just in case they wonder. So you clean the bowl, you wipe the bowl, and only then do you serve them tea. And then afterwards you clean and wipe the bowl again, so that when it is all done, it's like Orioki. You're back to where you started from. And actually, Orioki, I did Orioki for the first time before I did tea for the first time. And it was kind of a funny thing. Somebody was announcing, oh yes, this coming Saturday we will be doing Orioki breakfast. And I remember going up to my teacher Les and saying, so what's this Orioki thing? And he said to me, oh, it's wonderful. You'll love it. Just come. I had absolutely no training in it, no experience, had never seen it before, didn't know what it was, and I showed up, and here's this bowl. And I'm watching everybody, and I'm trying, you know, it's not easy the first time you do it, right? You're trying to figure out where everything's supposed to go, and of course you're not doing it right. But by the time we were done, I was hooked. I was like, wow, this is really cool. Everything contained in one little package. You start with it, you end with it, and it's already clean. You didn't have to go out to the kitchen and wash anything. Tea ceremonies like that, it's complete, all in itself. It's very pure. It's just like Zazen. Each time you sit down, it's complete, all in itself. And then you get up, and you do something else. Every time, it's like you sit down with your little Zazen package and you unwrap yourself. You know, in the old days, the old, old days, when I first started practice, the chant was, now I open Buddha's robe. And when you think of the fact that not everybody has a kesa or a rakusu, well, what is Buddha's robe? It is Buddha's mind. Now I open Buddha mind. I am opening myself. I am opening the mind that is a part of everything. And it is wide open while I am in Zazen. I may close it back down later, or I may not. When we've been in retreat for a long time, when the retreat is over, we feel so wide open and soft around the edges. Eventually, things happen and some of the edges come back, but they never come back completely. So we are opening this mind room, just like I am opening the tea ceremony. It's a place where we can be intimate. We don't have to say anything. We don't have to be anything for each other. We are all just breathing together. Which brings me to the last and possibly most wonderful, but I don't know, principle, jhaku. Jhaku means tranquility. It doesn't always happen for me. Maybe it doesn't always happen for you. I don't always feel tranquil at the end of my zazen. But a lot of times I do. I don't always feel tranquil while I'm serving tea, depending on whether I have students that I'm teaching versus when I'm working with my own teacher. But the last time I served tea, I had walked in and I had put the tea things down. And I was just getting settled. And I had just moved the tea bowl the first 2 inches. And I realized, wow, it's been a month. Isn't this wonderful? And I just sat there for a few seconds, enjoying how wonderful it was, how tranquil I felt in that moment. And later, I mentioned this to someone, and one of my tea students overheard, and she said, I saw that moment. I was sitting across from you, and this look of just joyful ease came over your face. That is what I wish for all of you. Dogen's Dharma Gate of joyful ease, tranquility, clear mind, the sound of rain, the feel of sun on your face, the wind in your hair.